From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. On the final day of its session last spring, the General Assembly voted to create a more flexible system for medical marijuana. We talk about what that means for sick Marylanders who want to use the drug to relieve pain or nausea. Then, without the star at the center of our solar system, life as we know it would not exist. But there's a lot we don't know about the sun. Nathan talks with the leader of a project to send a spacecraft to explore the sun up close.
You know, it's almost like touching and smelling and tasting what's going on there with the spacecraft and taking the data that we need to unravel these questions.
Plus, the Baltimore band Sojourn brings its blend of jazz and soul into our studios. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. 20 states and the District of Columbia allow medical use of marijuana. Patients can either buy or grow marijuana for a purpose like pain relief. In 2013, the Maryland General Assembly took a first cautious stab at creating a medical marijuana program. Marijuana was to be made available and its use studied by academic medical centers. But none of the academic centers in Maryland signed up to participate. Legislators decided before adjourning this spring to allow certified doctors to write prescriptions for medical marijuana that can be bought from licensed growers and dispensaries. I spoke about it by phone in April with the chair of Maryland's Medical Marijuana Commission, Dr. Paul Davis. Also with us was Ryan Vandry. He's an associate professor and researcher at the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. Also with us to talk about how this new program will work was Delegate Cheryl Glenn, a Democrat from Baltimore City. She was co-sponsor of the medical marijuana bill. One of the reasons Delegate Glenn has said she wanted to make medical marijuana accessible in Maryland was that she thought it would have helped her mother, who died of cancer 4 years ago.
It's an appetite stimulant, and doctors have, over the years, said that if you can prescribe medical marijuana to patients who are suffering debilitating illnesses and diseases, it would allow the patient to be able to eat, and in many cases, it relieves the pain and suffering. We've had a wealth of people come in every session since I've introduced the bill, which is 2007, and they talk about how the only relief they can get is from medical marijuana. Unfortunately, it's been illegal in the state of Maryland. Also, they talk about the ravages of the medicine that the FDA has approved and how those medicines have such negative side effects that they don't even want to deal with the traditional medications. Marijuana doesn't do that. And I'm just really elated that we've been able to accomplish this in Maryland. Not only my mom, but my brother-in-law also. I had two close family members who suffered and died right before my eyes.
So under the bill that you have co-sponsored, how will patients be able to get medical marijuana?
Let me also give a shout out to Dr. Dan Morheim, the only doctor in the legislature. He and I were, you know, Tom and Jerry team on this. We've been working on this ever since last year together.
Uh-huh.
And so what will happen is the Medical Marijuana Commission will license and regulate the growers and the dispensers. And people will be able to go to their doctor who they have a bona fide relationship with, who are suffering illnesses. This is not for people who say, I have a headache, I want some marijuana. This will be a tightly regulated program. And that doctor will be able to write a recommendation, a prescription. That doctor will also be certified by the commission. And then the person, either the patient or the caregiver, will be able to go to the dispensary to pick up the prescription of the medical marijuana, just like you do any other kind of medicine.
Dr. Davis, the Medical Marijuana Commission that you chair was created by last year's law that called for academic medical centers to distribute medical marijuana. How will doctors be trained in understanding how to prescribe marijuana?
Probably through MedCAI, which is the Maryland Doctors Association, and possibly an online training process.
And so would you expect all primary care doctors to undergo this kind of training? Will some choose to do it, some not? And if so, how will their patients know whether or not this is an option in that practice?
It's a really interesting question. Some states are more, as you know, more liberal. Some states are more conservative. I suspect that doctors in Maryland will be somewhat conservative. So I think we'll have enough to supply the issues that we have in order to help the patients that want or need medical marijuana, but I don't think we're going to see a surplus of doctors going out on the street, setting up shops, prescribing marijuana for everybody.
Ryan Vandry, you've studied the addictive effects of marijuana on the body. What questions pop up in your mind about how medical marijuana is being put in effect in Maryland?
My concern is just that whatever is implemented well. There are a number of different things that you have to look at in allowing something like marijuana to be available as a medicine. Some of the issues there is quality control. And you want to make sure that it's not just grown in somebody's backyard, but that it's grown under scrutiny, and that you have product and dose consistency and quality control that you'd want with any other medicine. And then you also want to be careful in terms of regulating the product that's out there. I visited a number of more liberal states out west where medical marijuana seems to be everywhere, and you see a lot of products that are a little bit, from my mind, disturbing a little bit, because you end up having things that are packaged as candy with all kinds of crazy names, and that's not medicine. There's no need for that in medicine. What you end up is having an open capitalist market that's really unregulated, and no one really knows what's in some of these products. They're not governed by any board. I think Maryland is taking a good step in the legislation in trying to protect some of that stuff and prevent some of that stuff. So I think that the intent of the Maryland legislation is very good. We just need to be careful to make sure that it's implemented the right way.
That's Ryan Vandry, a Hopkins researcher here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Dr. Paul Davis, chair of Maryland's Marijuana Commission, and Delegate Cheryl Glenn of Baltimore. We're talking about medical marijuana. Delegate Glenn, what about the point of the consistency and the knowing exactly how strong a quantity of marijuana is? Mm-hmm. Usually we count on the FDA, mm-hmm. to do that kind of thing, but this is a state project.
Exactly, and I'm glad to be able to respond to what Ryan just said. The Maryland legislation is very, very tightly restricted. A lot of work has gone into this product. It will not look like California at all. We will not have people who grow marijuana in their backyards or at home. This will be a system by which all growers and all dispensers will be licensed and regulated by the Medical Marijuana Commission. And I don't think that that model exists in many of the other places. And so the doctors will have to be certified. The patients and caregivers will have to have an identification card system. We will have the independent testing so that you know the quality of the marijuana that you get and the strains that you get is what's needed for your own particular debilitating condition. You know, a lot of strains are good for different illnesses, just like the strain that's used, it's called Charlotte's Web for the little girl that Dr. Sanjay Gupta documented in his documentary called Weed. So our program will be tightly restricted. We won't have any of those problems. I'm not saying that there won't be some bumps and lumps along the road, And we can always come back and address those in future legislation.
Ryan Vandry, you've written about marijuana withdrawal syndrome, that people can have difficulty quitting marijuana when their need for it is over. Is it any more difficult than some prescription pain relievers?
Well, I think it's very similar to what you have with any number of drugs. I did some research a few years back that showed that the withdrawal from marijuana is actually very similar to withdrawal from tobacco. But what you have to remember is really the intent and the duration of use plays an important role in that. When you look at what you talked about, prescription pain relievers, the most common case is someone, you know, gets hurt, they're prescribed a prescription pain reliever, they use it to the point that they need it, and then they stop. And they tend not to experience withdrawal or any problems like that. What you do have is a subset of people who then use beyond what their medical necessity is. And so it's going to be very important for us to kind of monitor and track that in medical marijuana patients to see what proportion of people who are recommended or prescribed marijuana actually use it, what the reaction to that is. So right now, in terms of medical benefit, we're really relying mostly on patient anecdote. There's very little controlled research that's been done. So it's going to be important for us in the state of Maryland to try to collect some data on this. And my most exciting part of the medical marijuana initiative in Maryland is the data reporting requirement.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask,
so that we're going to be able to actually.
We're almost out of time, and I want to ask Delegate Glenn. Mm-hmm. President Obama's administration has told federal prosecutors not to make prosecuting those who use medical marijuana a priority, but it's still illegal
under federal law.
How much at risk are people?
They are not at risk. Recently, I think a matter of a month or so ago, the Obama administration even released the banking industry to be able to do business with those medical marijuana programs. So all we have to do now is work with the federal government to get marijuana moved from the wrong schedule, Schedule 1. And we believe that that's only a matter of time, a short period of time before that happens.
I appreciate you all talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Delegate Cheryl Glenn of Baltimore co-sponsored the medical marijuana bill that passed this year in the General Assembly, along with Delegate Dan Morheim of Baltimore County. Dr. Paul Davis chairs the state's Medical Marijuana Commission, and Ryan Vandry is an associate professor and researcher at the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. We spoke in April. The commission is expected to publish its rules in about a month. We've got links to initial drafts of their work at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Put on your sunglasses. We're going to the sun. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1. I'm Nathan Sterner. Life on Earth depends on the sun. That giant nuclear furnace nearly 93 million miles away anchors our planet's orbit, and its light makes it possible for plants to grow so that animals can eat them. But despite its outsized role in our lives, there are quite a few things we still do not know about our star, something that's going to change in about 4 years. In 2018, a space mission led by the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel will send a spacecraft to try to answer some of our sun-related questions. I spoke about it last March with Nikki Fox, project scientist on the mission. I began by asking exactly what questions it's trying to answer.
The most fundamental one is, why is the atmosphere around the sun hotter than the sun? We know that the middle of the sun is billions of degrees, the surface is about 6,000 degrees, and then you would expect that it would be cooler as you got further away from the sun.
But it's not?
But it's not. It's actually several hundred times hotter just above the surface. So we're at a couple of million degrees. It's called the corona. It's that hazy atmosphere that you see during a solar eclipse when the moon blocks the sun and you see the black disk where the sun should be, and you suddenly see all that beautiful atmosphere around the sun. that's the corona, and that is actually hotter than the sun's surface, and that is one a very major mystery for us. There are several theories that could explain it, but they would not explain that it stays hot so long. All of them would say, yes, it heats up, but then it cools in about an hour. But this doesn't. It stays hot all the time, and it expands away from the sun. It gets accelerated. It moves away. We don't understand why. And we actually live in the atmosphere of the sun. It expands well beyond the orbits of Pluto.
The atmosphere of the sun is what? It's the size of the solar system?
Pretty much the atmosphere of the sun. We actually live in the atmosphere of the sun. The corona stands a couple of million miles away from the sun itself, but this ever-expanding area actually keeps going, and it bathes all of the planets, and we call that the solar wind, and it carries lots of solar material away from the sun and actually will affect us here on Earth. Some of the beautiful things that happen are we see fantastic aurora displays in the sky. We've even seen some in Baltimore in the last decade. But the nasty things, it can cause problems for astronauts, for spacecraft. It could bring a lot of radiation in. You can damage solar panels, can cause issues with power grids, pipelines, communication systems. And, you know, we rely on technology every day, and a lot of that technology can be affected by what's coming from the sun.
What are you hoping to learn about the solar wind by getting close enough to observe it? Well, a lot closer than we are now.
We're actually hoping to learn why it's there. You know, it's one of the main mysteries is what causes this corona, this atmosphere around the sun, to be hotter than the surface, and what is propelling this solar wind continually away from the sun. And the only way we can do that is to literally go up and touch the star. It's, you know, kind of man's first visit to a star. And we are going to go into the corona, into that region where this acceleration process, whatever it is happening. And we are going to go up and, you know, it's almost like touching and smelling and tasting what's going on there with the spacecraft and taking the data that we need to unravel these questions.
Now, you have said we are actually within the sun's atmosphere here on Earth. Mm-hmm. How close do you have to get to the sun to, as you've categorized it, touch it? What constitutes touching the sun?
It's really close. So if you think of the sun and the Earth separated by a meter stick, mm-hmm. and so you've got the sun at zero and the Earth at a meter, the Mercury planet is about 35, 32 centimeters in, depending where it is, towards the sun. Our closest spacecraft that's been up in this region before was at about 29 centimeters. We are going to 4 centimeters. We are going right up to the sun.
How hot is it going to get?
It is going to get very hot. we did consider going at night, so that would help. But we were told no, we had to go during the day. So actually, we'll fly up very close. It will be about 1,400 degrees that we have to worry about when we get there. So it's hot. If you're lying on a beach on the Earth and you feel the heat of the sun, it's about 500 times hotter than that.
You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, speaking with Nikki Fox, a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel. She's one of the leaders of a project that will send a spacecraft to explore the sun. How are you going to get there? You can't just fly straight at the sun, right? You have to do some sort of technical flyby sorts of things in order to make it close enough?
Yes, that's right. We actually do flybys, kind of slingshot, around the planet Venus, and we do that 7 times to continually get closer to the sun. But our very first closest approach is, you know, on our meter scale, mm-hmm. it's still about 16 centimeters. So we're still going close, even on the very first orbit. But we use it's a 7-year mission. We have 24 orbits, and we fly past the planet Venus 7 times to kind of kick us closer to the sun. So we kind of walk in towards the sun little by little until we get to that 4-centimeter mark.
What happens after the 24th orbit? Does the spacecraft just get too close?
No. No? The last orbit is actually is a stable orbit.
So it's going to stay there?
And it could stay there. It becomes a money problem at that point. But if everything is still healthy, there is no reason that the spacecraft cannot continue on that orbit as long as you want, taking that fantastic data.
The spacecraft itself is not yet built, correct?
It's not yet built. We're now doing what I would call more like the detailed design. The honing everything up, getting everything right before we cut metal. But the design of the spacecraft and the mission itself is really complete.
And it's launching in 2018.
2018, yes, from Florida.
What sorts of things are keeping you up at night as you plan for this mission?
Oh, golly. Mostly excitement, actually, over I can't wait to get there. It's such a privilege to be involved in a mission that is, well, it was 1958 was the first time it was proposed.
This has been a very long time in coming.
It is a very long time in coming. And, the reason we had to wait so long is that there really wasn't the technology to be able to do it. It is such a challenging mission to fly up to this very, very hostile environment, not just the heat, but the radiation and the dust.
All the stuff from the solar wind, it's going to be getting the brunt of it right there.
Absolutely. And the fact that we don't really know what we're going to find. It is a voyage of discovery. You know, it's like you wonder if the Earth's flat or round and you give it a go and you hope you don't fall off. And it's kind of like that. You know, we really don't know what we're going to find, but it's mostly just excitement of, I just can't wait to get there.
Nikki Fox is a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel. She's one of the leaders of a project that will send a spacecraft to explore the sun in 2018. We spoke back in March. We've got more information on our website, including a drawing of what the solar probe will look like. Come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. There's more Maryland Morning yet to come. Stay with us here on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Morning, everybody. Welcome back. I'm glad you're with us. It's 88.1 WIPR, Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, an in-studio performance by the pop and R&B band Sojourn. But first, the Baltimore Playwrights Festival has introduced three new plays in this year's edition. Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see the festival's final production. It's a play called 14 Days in July. Here's her review.
Although 14 Days in July focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian summit at Camp David in July 2000, one of the play's most moving scenes takes place at Gettysburg. Middle East envoy Dennis Ross accompanies Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to visit the Civil War battlefield. Barak draws a chilling parallel between that war and the dangers facing his own country. The conversation then shifts from political history to personal history. Louis K. Schrager adapted 14 Days in July from the memoir The Missing Piece by Ambassador Ross, the playwright's longtime friend. Produced by the Theatrical Mining Company as part of the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, the play examines the politics, personalities, and frustrations of the unsuccessful summit.
This isn't about tactics anymore. The president's patience has run out. It's time to get past the games. We're running out of time here. We need to get down to the real give and take.
John Robert Wright portrays Ross, the play's guide and storyteller. Under Barry Feinstein's direction, Wright imbues this dedicated diplomat with seriousness tempered with genuine humanity. Along with the Gettysburg scene, a series of recurring phone conversations with Ross's wife offer a glimpse of the man outside the tense negotiations. Wright's portrayal is the fulcrum of the production, which I saw in rehearsal. Percy W. Thomas also gives an intense portrayal of adamant Yasser Arafat. The Palestinian Authority chairman repeatedly calls Tom Blair's President Clinton his friend, but ultimately proves intransigent.
The Israelis did what I asked. From your guys, nothing.
Mr. President, I heard what the Israelis offered. It was not very much. Years ago, Prime Minister Rabin promised me much more.
He did not!
The insights in 14 Days help illuminate the misinterpretations and missed opportunities that not only prevented peace then, but continue to embroil relations today. Playwright Schrager borrowed considerable text from Ross's book. He trimmed the nearly 24 negotiators down to a cast of 11, still a large number by today's stage standards. and the playwright missed a few opportunities to dramatize scenes that are merely narrated, particularly when the Israeli delegation hosts a Shabbat dinner. Coincidentally, a play called simply Camp David by Lawrence Wright premiered at Washington's Arena Stage in March. Wright's play focused on President Carter's 1978 treaty-producing Middle East peace talks. It also had a strong scene set at Gettysburg. But despite the star-studded cast at Arena, the Baltimore Playwrights Festival's modest, unevenly cast production has a gritty, behind-the-scenes accessibility, due in no small part to the human scale of the character of Ross. 14 Days in July is one of only three plays in this summer's Baltimore Playwrights Festival. Of the five plays originally announced, two were canceled, one due to artistic differences and the other due to a casting shortage partly attributable to Baltimore's burgeoning theater scene. The result is the smallest lineup in the festival's 33-year history. The Playwrights Festival still receives upwards of 70 submissions a year, and, as it has for a decade, it will participate in the Kennedy Center's Page to Stage Festival in a few weeks. But Baltimore Playwrights Festival organizers acknowledge that it's time to revitalize and grow into the 21st century. Having followed the Baltimore Playwrights Festival for three decades, I know that it fills a need, developing and presenting new plays by Maryland playwrights. Seeing a work like 14 Days in July furthers my hope that the festival can meet its challenges, restructure, and come back bolder and healthier next summer.
You can catch the Theatrical Mining Company's production of 14 Days in July at LeClerc Hall on the campus of Notre Dame University of Maryland. Shows are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday until August 31st. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning for all the details. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, returns on September 8th with a review of the Everyman Theater's new show. And later that week, Judy and I will talk about the upcoming theater season, and we'll take note of some of the highlights on this season's theatrical calendar. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Sojourn is a Baltimore-based band whose style is informed by the classical training of the woman who fronts it, Trina Coleman. Trina and her husband Zachary teamed up with drummer Steve McGrath and bassist Tim Long to form Sojourn in 2013. Their latest CD is called Due Time. This is a tune called All Right Here.
Brown grass growing on my side of the path I see. Over there it's coming up roses, or so it seems. I want it to be true, but I've met a thorn or two in my travels, and I know it's not perfect there either. So maybe all we need is a watering can and not a relocation plan.
It's been 6 years since Rolling Stone magazine named Baltimore the city with the best music scene in America. Since then, there's been no shortage of new bands and venues becoming part of that scene, and Sojourn is certainly one of the bands that's making its mark. Last February, three of the four members of the band, Trina Coleman, Zachary Coleman, and Steve McGrath, joined me in the studio to perform and to talk about their work. Trina Coleman was trained as a classical singer at one of the country's most prestigious music schools, the Westminster Choir College. I know Trina as a classical soprano because she sings with us in the Choral Arts Society. I asked her how her classical background informs her work as a jazz and soul singer.
Being a classical singer creates the foundation for everything else. It creates the agility and the way to sing way up high and way down low at the same time, you know. Without being a classically trained singer, I think I would really struggle with those aspects of singing what I hear, executing what I hear. Mm-hmm. And instead, I have the ability to kind of to go further, so much further with that foundation.
Because your training was actually to be a music teacher, right?
Yeah. I went to school for music education.
Yeah.
And at Westminster Choir College, when you study voice, you study classical voice. That's just how it works there. So I got an incredible education there. And I still challenge myself to think of myself as a classical soloist. It's more of being a choral singer, which I think is the first thing that I probably started with. I come from a very musical family. And I think that initial beginning of being a musician, you know, the choral singing and the classical singing is really where where I've been able to propel forward from. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're writing a lot of the material with your husband, Zach. Zach, do you guys, what's that writing experience like? Collaborating with your wife on writing tunes.
Tell the truth.
Well, sometimes it's...
truth or dare here, Zach.
It's a wonderful gift to be able to do that. It really is. And, you know, delayed for me to be able to kind of, like, watch some of the ideas that Trina kind of comes up with unfold. And, you know, we kind of, like, both come at it from our own separate ways. And, you know, I may have, like, a melody or, like, a chord progression or something that I'm working through. And then it kind of, like, rounds out the idea that she has. And it's neat to kind of like watch her kind of stew on an idea for a long time, and then you look a year later, you're like, I remember when that started, you know. But it's a highly collaborative, you know, kind of endeavor. So,
well, let's hear one of those tunes. This is not a tune that's on the current album, but it's available on YouTube. This is a tune called Sore Loser, and you guys have been nice enough to Zach, you brought your guitar, and Steve, you brought your Cajun drum box. So Trina Coleman, you're going to sing us a tune. Thanks.
I'm not exactly commercial. This doesn't feel like rehearsal. The movements I make, the time that it takes, it seems like reversal. I'm feeling tall and important, really Napoleon short. And I got a feeling I'm not alone, so just hold the phone, pick up the pieces while I can. I thought I knew where and when and why, but I was calling an opera lullaby. They say you gotta believe and try, you know. We can't all fly. We can't all fly. I'm in a serious pickle. Better if I would just fickle. I've got this infernal hope, no joke. Just cannot cope with middle. See, there's this pie in the sky, and just gotta rent me a giant to reach up, grab me a piece, so please won't someone talk me down. Oh, I thought I knew where and when and who, but I was calling an ostrich a kangaroo. They say you gotta believe and do his mind, but it's not quite true. It's got me feeling blue. So, and better luck next time, truth be told, there's no reason or rhyme. Round pegs and square holes just don't go. Oh, no, they don't. Maybe it's not the right angle. Maybe it's sink or swim. Maybe you learn to swim in the sky. Maybe that's how you win. Maybe I've got the wrong angle. Maybe it's sink or swim. Maybe I'll learn to swim in sky. It's not that high. Oh, I thought I knew where and when and what, but I was calling a lemon a coconut. Oh, I thought I knew how and where and when. Oh, won't someone just break out those violins? They say don't stop believing, but in what it might give you. To try, we've gotta try. Whoa, we've got to try. We've got to try. Ooh, whoa, we've got to.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This morning, we're revisiting a performance and conversation with the Baltimore-based band Sojourn. Trina Coleman, Zachary Coleman, and Steve McGrath performed for us in studio last February. That was a tune called Sore Loser. Trina told us about the background of that composition.
We had kind of a stockpile of songs that we had written, and we hadn't shared them. We just weren't brave. And we ended up with kind of an experience that made us look at our lives and go, wow, if everything was gone, would we have regrets? And the answer was, yeah, we hadn't shared these songs, you know. So it was time to be brave, and I entered a singer-songwriter contest on YouTube, which is terrifying. It was my first YouTube video. And I lost by a lot. So Sore Loser is actually
losing. You and a whole bunch of other people.
Me and thousands of people, of course. But Sore Loser is, it's spelled S-O-A-R, and it's about losing that competition and how it feels and how we got to try anyway.
Yeah, but Steve, that the loss of that competition actually led to the founding of this band, didn't it?
It did, yeah. You know, when Zach and Trina first invited me over to their house, they said, hey, we've been writing some songs, and we really want you to be a part of this. And actually, one of the songs off our EP, Lady Grey Gardens, they played that song for me, and I just thought, wow, there's so many directions I can take this and do with this as far as, you know, groove and rhythm, and, you know, it's just been great, you know, to have that freedom in this band to create.
And Lady Grey Gardens is based on a documentary film from the 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, it sort of paralleled with something that we had been watching unfold in our own lives. And the story just struck me because of how easily people could slip into that. You know, how easily the world could just fall apart with that documentary where the ladies, you know, this mother and daughter end up, you know, codependent and just sad and just utter disarray if you've seen this documentary. And that kind of paints this picture both musically and lyrically for us of kind of this chaos and tension. You can hear it in the music as well.
Because you write about a lot of things that come from your personal experience. One of them is the fact that you're a mixed race person, mm-hmm. and you have a beautiful tune on this album called Oh My Soul, which quotes a famous line from the civil rights movement, my feet is tired, but my soul is rested.
Yeah.
Where'd that tune come from?
That was one that I almost threw away. I started writing it, and I liked the soulfulness of it, and it was about being, you know, inspired to reconcile some hard relationships with compassion. And it wasn't actually racially related at all, and I had put it away for a long time because it just wasn't coming together. Took it out, dusted it off, tried to rework the words, and suddenly that quote came to my mind. And, you know, that's probably a songwriting moment I'll remember forever, just jamming and realizing these words are already here, and they fit, and I'm passionate about these words. And it just rejuvenated the entire song for me. Oh, my feet is tired, but my soul is restless. My feet is tired, but my soul is restless. My feet is tired, but my soul is restless.
Well, this is crazy. I mean, this sounds like this has sort of been brewing, you know, for a long time. This the whole band and the whole endeavor of playing together. So that's great. Well, we're glad you finally got this stuff out of the shoebox and shared it with
us
the rest
too.
Of us. Well, thanks so much, you guys, for coming by. I really appreciate it. It's great to hear you, and thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Trina and Zachary Coleman joined me in the studio last February, along with drummer Steve McGrath. Tim Long rounds out the band Sojourn. Their CD is called Due Time. You can catch Sojourn a week from Friday at the Creative Alliance in Baltimore. They're appearing on a show called Charm City Original Soul. They'll share the bill with jazz pianist Mark Meadows and vocalists Nikki Lerner and Irene Gelenti. The show starts at 8 o'clock Friday night, August 29th. That's Labor Day weekend. The Creative Alliance is in East Baltimore next to Patterson Park. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, for all the details. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Coming up Wednesday, a conversation about the ways people grieve. And Sheila will introduce us to a real-life Rosie the Riveter. I'll also talk to the Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid about his novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. That's all coming up Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.